our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report declares wind energy development in Umatilla County could make a great impact on Oregon's economy.
We will conclude our two-part interview series with Jason Leopold regarding Rove and the Valerie Plame leak investigation.
And the Sudanese government and the main Darfur rebel group have signed a peace plan that hopes to end the tragedy in western Sudan.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,415 officially acknowledged deaths of U.S. soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 38,861 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. And the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Viernes, el Cinco de Mayo, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. The Oregon Supreme Court on Thursday overturned a lower court's ruling that required employers to make allowances for workers who use medical marijuana. Judges on the state's highest court issued a tightly focused ruling, concluding that if an employee's disability can be mitigated through treatment, employers need not make special allowances for that employee. However, the judges skirted the issue of whether an employee can be disciplined at work for using doctor-approved medical marijuana at home. The case had been cast as a showdown between an employer's right to ensure safe workplaces versus a worker's right to treat their pain with pot. The case involves Robert Washburn, a former millwright at the Columbia Forest Products plant at Klamath Falls, who was fired after urine tests showed traces of marijuana in his system. Washburn had a state-issued card allowing him to use marijuana to ease leg spasms that disrupted his sleep. About 11,000 Oregonians have received such state-issued cards since voters passed a physician-approved medical marijuana law in 1998. The court found that Washburn was not disabled under state law because he had previously successfully treated his condition with painkillers, and that Washburn's employer, therefore, was not obligated to make allowances for him showing up for work with marijuana in his system. Liam?
Wind energy development in Umatilla County could provide a multi-million dollar impact on the state's economy, according to a recent special report released by the Oregon State University Extension Service. OSU researchers used economic models developed by the National Energy Renewable Laboratory and the university to estimate both the current impact of the wind industry and also what the impact of wind energy development would be in an optimized economy. An optimized economy is one in which at least 75% of the businesses and facilities needed to support wind development are local. According to the report, Umatilla County's economic structure and the economic impacts of wind energy development and input-output analysis. Umatilla County's wind industry has the potential to grow into a $40 million business and provide numerous new jobs to the area's rural communities if local infrastructure is developed. The OSU study focused on Umatilla County, which is Oregon's leader in wind energy development. Umatilla County has the capacity to generate about 480 gigawatt hours of wind energy per year, or enough energy to power roughly 46,000 Oregon homes annually.
Some long-term research on the vast coral reefs around American Samoa has revealed a success story in efforts to halt destruction of these threatened ecosystems and shown that sustained efforts to rebuild them can be effective. A recent survey by geographers from Oregon State University, using submersibles to study the reefs at depths rarely seen before, showed that in general, the reefs are not only doing well, but some species are thriving that weren't even known in the area before. American Samoa historically has had outstanding coral reefs, which were almost wiped out in the 1990s by dynamite fishing, hurricanes, starfish invasion, as well as raw sewage from tuna factories flooding into the ocean waters. However, the report suggests a grassroots educational program since then has helped educate the local public about the fragile nature of their reefs, created information on, created informational sessions in schools and villages, cut back on the abuses, and stopped much of the pollution. The recent studies were supported by a $230,000 grant from the National Undersea Research Program and used ships and facilities from the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory. More details on this work can be found on the web at dusk.geo.orst.edu/DJL/Samoa/hurl.
Cherry growers in the Pacific Northwest are optimistic they could top last year's record harvest and provide a long cherry-filled summer for consumers. The harvest is expected to include a number of new varieties that ripen later in the summer. It's all good news after a year in which growers couldn't meet demand. California and the Pacific Northwest produce the bulk of the nation's sweet cherries. Growers in Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and Utah harvested a record 117,000 tons of fresh cherries last year. The early estimate for the 2006 four-state fresh crop ranges between 110 and 130,000 tons, with much of the harvest in Washington. Washington State has an estimated 29,000 acres of cherry orchards, up from about 25,000 acres in 2004. That number continues to increase as growers tear out apple orchards and replace them with cherry trees and wine grape vineyards, which have been more profitable in recent years. Bing cherries make up 60% of the Washington state crop, down from 80% about 10 years ago. They've been replaced by the later ripening varieties such as Sweetheart and Lepin cherries. As a result, the harvest from mid-July to mid-August should grow by about 5%.
Gasoline prices are staying above $3 a gallon across much of Oregon. Oregon-Idaho AAA spokesperson Elliot Icke says that prices won't drop anytime soon. However, another analyst says he doubts the high prices can be sustained. The $3 price had been expected, but not before the Memorial Day weekend. Ecke says the demand is putting such upward pressure on gas prices that, quote, you'd be crazy not to find ways to conserve. In the Portland area, TriMet reported a 4.5% jump in ridership on the Max Light Rail system. This was during the first 3 weeks in April.
Investigative reporter Jason Leopold with truthout.com is hot on the trail of Karl Rove's indictment on charges he helped leak Valerie Plame's identity as a CIA operative. This week, Jason spoke with KBOO's Lisa Loving about Rove, Watergate, and the irony of Washington Post investigative reporter Bob Woodard's involvement with both. This is part two of the interview.
Now, when this particular leak occurred, There were some journalists, there were a handful of journalists who were involved, and some of those journalists have been known to report their stories have been very beneficial to the Bush administration, particularly Judith Miller and her reporting for the New York Times, which, you know, many argued had laid the foundation to war, and you know, her stories were held up as proof of, you know, the Iraqi threat, when in fact, you know, she was actually the recipient of leaked information from the very people who held up her stories as, you know, as proof. And it, what we didn't know is how Bob Woodward, what role he played in this. And it wasn't until the indictment of Scooter Libby that Bob Woodward suddenly appeared out of nowhere and said that he, in fact, may have been the first journalist to have learned about Valerie Plame, the covert CIA agent. He may have been the first one to have learned about her identity. And it just so happened that when Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, held a press conference to announce the indictment, he started going through a list of dates. And one of the dates that came up, I forgive me, but I don't have it exact, but it was around late June, early July, when they said that Judith Miller and Matt Cooper, who is a reporter from Time Magazine, found out the identity from Libby about Valerie Plame. And then Bob Woodward, in his first-person account, which he wrote about in the Washington Post, said that he contacted his source and realized that, in fact, he was the first one. Bob Woodward was the first one to have, he learned about her identity well before those other reporters did. So suddenly Bob Woodward, who has been out there, downplaying the importance of this leak, of the scandal, of, you know, what it meant, how it affected her work with the CIA, suddenly we now find out that all along he was involved in this, and he did not disclose that. And that's incredibly troubling, because Bob Woodward still holds, you know, people still hold him in high regard. When people think of investigative journalism, they often think about Watergate. They often think about all the president's men, and that is, you know, what is looked at as what reporters aspire to. I know that's what I aspired to when I started out. So it's very disappointing, and to find out that somebody of his stature had simply been the been a lapdog for the administration.
That was truthout.org investigative reporter Jason Leopold.
A new report issued by the National Priorities Project reveals the numbers relating to the class and race of military recruits. FSRN's Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more about the report, which indicates the poor make up the predominant portion of recruits.
Those who make more than $60,000 are underrepresented in the Army. The majority of military recruits come from communities who make less than the median income.
70% of black recruits come from such neighborhoods, and 64% of Hispanic recruits.
Anita Dunch is research director at the National Priorities Project, the group who compiled the data from the 2004 recruiting year.
We don't know what the income level of the recruits themselves are, but we know what the median household income level of the neighborhoods that they come from. And what that indicates is that, yes, if you are in a lower middle income neighborhood, you're more likely to enlist.
The Department of Defense does not collect demographic data on each person that applies. These general statistics were obtained through a FOIA request by Peacework magazine. The report reveals that blacks are overrepresented in the military, with the national rate being 1.7 black recruits per 1,000 black youth. That's compared to 1.6 white youth per 1,000. The report shows what many already knew, that the military consists disproportionately on low income and people of color, which is why counter-recruitment actions take place across the country. Jeannie Schwab is with the American Friends Service Committee, a group protesting military recruitment since the 1980s.
The reason why AFSC folks got involved was because of the disproportionate targeting of low-income and youth and racial minorities.
Since the war in Iraq, recruitment numbers have not risen to levels the Army desires. They have begun implementing large monetary incentives up to $50,000. Congressman Charles Rangel, Democrat from New York, believes the answer to even out the representation of the military is to implement a draft.
We don't have a shared sacrifice. It seems to me that if the president is putting the military option on the table with Iran, is rattling the swords for Syria and North Korea, that America, if they believe it's in our national security interests, then more people than those who come from poor communities should be asked to serve.
He has introduced a bill each year since the war in Iraq began, but has received little support from other congressional members. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Early this morning, longtime environmental and justice activist Damuse Smith died after a fight with colon cancer. FSRN's Ingrid Drake and Reem Katkuda bring us Damu's voice from the D.C. Radio Co-op archives.
The spirits, Denmark Vesey, Matt Turner.
Whether at the Lincoln Memorial in 2003, at the 40th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's March on Washington, in peace rallies, or on a panel of conferences across the world, Tammuz Smith spoke of peace and justice relentlessly. Smith was born into a working-class family in St. Louis, Missouri in 1952. As a college student, Smith led a protest and takeover of the school's administrative offices demanding a black studies program. Smith then took leadership roles in the fight against apartheid in South Africa, the occupation of Palestine, gun violence, police brutality, and a freeze on nuclear weapons.
We cannot segregate our issues, brothers and sisters. We can't have civil rights over here, peace over here, gay rights over there, women rights over there. We got to connect all the dots, because those who are against us have a broad agenda. They are united for their agenda. We've got to be united for ours.
In 1999, Smith coordinated the National Emergency Gathering of Black Community Advocates for Environmental and Economic Justice, the largest environmental justice conference ever held. Tammuz founded Black Voices for Peace to amplify the voice of the black community in the global justice movement. Smith also hosted Spirit in Action, a show on WPFW, Pacifica's DC station. Smith leaves behind many family and friends, including Asha, his 12-year-old daughter. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ingrid Drake with Reem Katkuda.
CIA Director Porter Ghost resigned unexpectedly today, leaving behind a spy agency still trying to recover from the scars of intelligence failures before America's worst terrorist attack and faulty information that formed the U.S. rationale for invading Iraq. It was the latest move in a second-term shakeup of George Bush's team. Making the announcement from the Oval Office, Bush called Ghost's tenure one of transition. He did not name a successor, but said that person would continue Ghost's reform. Ghost, a former member of Congress from Florida, head of the House Intelligence Committee and CIA agent, had been at the helm of the agency since September 2004. He came under fire almost immediately, in part because he brought with him several top aides from Congress who were considered highly political for the CIA. Just 2 weeks ago, Goss announced the firing of a top intelligence analyst in connection with a Pulitzer Prize-winning story about a network of CIA prisons in Eastern Europe. Such dismissals are highly unusual.
A 14-year-old boy beaten by guards at a juvenile boot camp died because the guards suffocated him, a medical examiner said Friday. The findings of the second autopsy on Martin Lee Anderson conflict with the initial ruling from a different medical examiner that the boy died from complications of sickle cell trait, a usually benign blood disorder. The boy's body was exhumed after a camp surveillance videotape surfaced showing the guards beating him the day before he died. The videotape shows Anderson being kneed, struck, and dragged by guards on his first day at the Bay County Sheriff's Boot Camp for juvenile offenders. He was eventually taken to a Pensacola hospital, where he died a few hours later on January 6th. No one has been arrested in connection with the death, which sparked protests at the state capitol, forced lawmakers to scrap the military-style camps, and led to the resignation of the state's top law enforcement officer.
And now, almost 19 minutes after 5, time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Time to take another peek into the lifestyles of the rich and cranky. People think it's easy being rich, but these peasants know nothing about the crushing pressure of always having to stand out in the crowd, if only for appearance's sake. Take the Kentucky Derby. This annual Run for the Roses is the preeminent social event for the horsey set. It's a grand setting, a place to see and be seen, an occasion to wear your Versace white suit and your $1,000 handmade Panama hat, and of course, a place for sipping the royalty of southern drinks, mint juleps. But there's the rub, you see. These days, mint juleps have become so commonplace at the Derby that they're serving them in plastic cups. How can one stand out if even the hoi polloi are sloshing down juleps like they were Slurpees? Well, thank goodness for Woodford Reserve. For this year's Derby, this distillery has rescued your truly rich by offering a drink worthy of them. Called the Ultimate Mint Julep, it's made with only the finest Kentucky bourbon, mint imported from Morocco, sugar from the South Pacific, and ancient ice brought in from the Arctic Circle. Equally important, the UMJ is served in a gold-plated cup and sipped through a silver straw. Now that's class. The beautiful part is that this libation comes with a price tag of $1,000 per drink, not including tip. The price is beautiful because it will separate the true hoity-toities from the riffraff, and the world will be in proper balance once again. This is Jim Hightower saying, not only does the ultimate mint julep let the rich rise above the rest of us, but it also lets them show their philanthropic side. For the distiller will donate the drink's profits to a charity for retired racehorses. What do you bet that the rich get a bar receipt for each of their $1,000 juleps so they can deduct the cost from their income taxes as a charitable contribution? Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6, Bread and Roses. At 7 o'clock, Jay's Place. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy in the evening and then mostly cloudy with lows around 45. And tomorrow, mostly cloudy and cooler with highs around 65. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The Sudanese government and the main Darfur rebel group signed a peace plan today, which means a major step in the international effort to end the death and destruction in Western Sudan. Two other rebel groups, however, rejected the accord backed by the African Union, the United States, Britain, the European Union, and the Arab League, and did not attend the signing ceremony at a Nigerian presidential villa. Optimism over the deal was muted by their absence, and a history of failure to live up to agreements struck over 2 years of negotiations in the Nigerian capital. A ceasefire signed in 2004 also failed. The peace deal calls for a ceasefire, disarmament of so-called Janjaweed militias linked to the government, and accused of some of the worst atrocities, the integration of thousands of rebel fighters into Sudan's armed forces, and a protection force for civilians in the immediate aftermath of the war. At least 180,000 people have been killed and more than 2 million forced to flee their homes in what the United Nations has called one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. The Darfur conflict, which erupted in February of 2003, also has spilled into Chad and Central African Republic. Liam.
Cities around Mexico are participating in solidarity mobilizations for the survivors of violence at Atenco. Hundreds of people in Guadalajara, Monterrey, Cuernavaca, and Mexico City participated in different actions. In Oaxaca, teachers and social organizations marched to condemn political violence. And yesterday, one resident of the autonomous municipality of San Blas Atempa was assassinated in the south of Oaxaca, where Subcomandante Marco participated in support actions in February. FSRN's Vladimir Flores reports.
Faustino Acevedo Bailon, treasurer of the self-declared autonomous municipality of San Blas Atempa, was killed in an ambush by gunmen last night just as he was preparing to travel to this weekend's National Indigenous Congress in central Mexico. Faustino Acevedo's brother, Antonio Acevedo, describes what happened.
My brother was arriving at his house when two unknown men came up on bicycles and shot him. He fell over, fighting hand to hand with one of them in defense. Since there were two of them, the other took advantage of the situation and they killed him right there.
The Zapatista caravan visited the autonomous municipality of San Blas Atempa in February as part of the nationwide Other campaign. In March, hundreds of police occupied the town and took control of the town hall. The heavy police presence continues in the small town. According to José González Jiménez, member of the autonomous municipal government, these forms of aggression against entire towns have a clear political motive.
I think that on the eve of the presidential elections, where the priestas are seeing that defeat is on the way, I think they're sowing a climate of terror and insecurity throughout the country.
Members of the autonomous municipal government will travel to the Indigenous National Congress this weekend to discuss their next steps. Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News, Oaxaca, Mexico.
Thousands of people fled East Timor's capital today as rumors circulated via mobile phone text messages that disgruntled ex-soldiers who clashed with police last week were preparing an attack, officials and witnesses said. Residents started leaving for villages outside the city a week after fighting in the city between hundreds of former soldiers and police left 5 people dead and dozens injured. The violence prompted foreign missions to advise non-essential staff to leave the capital and raised fears the government in the fledgling country had lost control. The military fired nearly 600 soldiers in March after they went on strike to protest working conditions. They have threatened to keep up their attacks if the government fails to resolve the conflict. Last week, soldiers went on a rampage in Dili, setting fire to cars and shops. 5 people were killed and dozens injured. A number of countries recalled embassy staff and alerted their citizens to the violence. In August 1999, East Timor's people voted for independence after 24 years of Indonesian rule, during which civil rights groups estimated between 100,000 and 250,000 people were killed. That's the KBU Evening News for Cinco de Mayo, Friday, May 5th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kbu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our audio editor is Lisa Loving. Our technological superhero is Jim Thompson, and special thanks to reporter Lisa Loving. Our engineers, Brian Averill. The KBU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annalisa Hummel. Si se puede, somos todos niñas del cosmos. Good night.
Coming up Monday morning on KBU at 7, hear the KBU Morning News. At 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. They'll have an open forum. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. Listen as the moles undermine institutions of domination, war, imperialism, and government powers enthralled to the very rich. At 10, it's Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. He'll host a roundtable discussion with a naturopathic physician and a Chinese medical practitioner about natural treatments for menopause and about an upcoming community clinic about menopause. And at 10:30 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen welcomes Marge Barker and Harriet Fassenfest to discuss their new business, which seeks to educate in the art and science of home food preservation. And at 11, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-owned community radio station. Thanks for joining us. Good night.
Buenas noches, Liam.